Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. On today's show, the inspirational public theologian, Reverend Dr. Jackie Lewis from the Middle Collegiate Church in the East Village, joins us to talk about revisiting the burned down sanctuary there at 2nd Avenue and East 7th Street. Also, an election year-related conference she has coming up next week, and the idea of common humanity, Jackie Lewis, for her latest appearance later this hour. Also, an argument for getting tech out of schools, even educational technology deployed by educators for educational purposes. That argument from New York Times Parenting and Family Life columnist Jessica Gross. And speaking of family life, a call in at the end of the show on why you love the children's program Bluey, even if you're an adult, but also the controversial Bluey special that was recently released about a family, their family, planning to move to another city for the dad's better job, and the controversial ending that Bluey episode had. That's all coming up, but let's start with national politics. What a week it's been in Congress. Speaker Mike Johnson seems to be facing the latest revolt from members of his own Republican caucus that could cost him his position as Speaker for even bringing to a vote a bill on aid to Ukraine that members are free to vote against. Here's the former Democratic Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, kind of amazed at that revolt, even after Johnson gave MAGA Republicans something they wanted, separating the bill on aid to Ukraine from the more universally popular one on aid to Israel.
The Republicans should help Johnson. He's given them everything they want. Why won't the Republicans take yes for an answer? You don't want to vote for this? Don't vote for it. We split it all up.
Nancy Pelosi, little different sounding from revolt leader Marjorie Taylor Greene.
I don't know how much longer our members are going to tolerate the Republican speaker that we elected to pass our agenda in the House. We don't know. I don't know how long people are going to tolerate this because he's doing nothing but serving the Democrats.
Wait, is the polarized Congress in a moment of bipartisan coalition government? We're going to talk about that concept. There was also the impeachment non-trial in the Senate for Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas, a shouting match between Democrat Jamie Raskin and Republican James Comer. We'll play a little of that later on the Biden impeachment inquiry. Another Ivy League president, Manoush Shafiq from Columbia, grilled on anti-Semitism on campus, even as conflict on the campus between the administration and protesters was coming to a head. Congress can agree on renewing a post-9/11 warrantless surveillance act. And relevant to the campaign trail, remember this is an election year, did you know that? Senate Democrats are ramping up a big spending campaign to try to hold their slim Senate majority, which is definitely threatened considering the states that are in play. With us now, Burgess Everett, Congressional Bureau Chief for Politico. Happy Friday, Burgess. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. It's a busy Friday indeed.
Let's start with this Ukraine bill. What did Speaker Johnson do here, splitting up the Israel and Ukraine funding proposals?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a jujitsu because, as you heard former Speaker Pelosi talk about it, they do get individual votes on each component. But what is going to happen in the end is the entire package will be sent over to the Senate as a whole. And so what's happening now on the House floor is they're debating the rule for this, which is what packages all those things together. So while it is technically true, they are all going to get individual votes. In the end, this is going to go over as a package, kind of very similar to the Senate bill that passed in February. And that's where a lot of the hand-wringing on the right is coming from, because ultimately it is a similar package to this Senate package, which Speaker Johnson said he did not like not that long ago.
All right. I'll admit I already don't understand, and so probably a lot of listeners don't either. How can both things be true, that they're supposedly separating the Israel and Ukraine funding bills or votes, but it's going to be sent over to the package, over to the Senate as one package?
Yeah, I mean, it's a way to let everybody express their individual preference on each component. And if a component did fail, it would not be part of the package. However, we expect all of the components to pass. And the reason this matters is the House, in a perfect world, would probably prefer to send over each one as an individual bill. But as a connoisseur of the Senate, I can tell you that would just take absolutely forever for the Senate to pass. And so they need it as a package. Otherwise, it would probably take a month to pass four individual different bills because of objections from members of Congress on each individual component. So basically, it's an expediency way to get this into law much more quickly by rolling everything together.
The Politico Playbook morning newsletter has an intriguing subject line, Mike Johnson's coalition government. I don't think you wrote that one, but somebody in your on your team did. Mike Johnson's coalition government. Coalition government in the polarized moment that we're in this country, especially in Congress?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we've been watching basically all Congress because of the divisions in the House being so narrow. The Republicans thought they were going to get a huge majority and be able to steamroll Democrats all over the place. That's not what happened. That's ultimately why Kevin McCarthy had such a difficult time becoming Speaker. It's why he agreed to include the motion to vacate, which is the thing that Marjorie Taylor Greene is holding over Mike Johnson's head, which allows one member to spark a referendum on the Speaker at any one time. And their majority has only gotten smaller in recent months because of retirements and people leaving Congress early. So to pass pretty much anything of consequence when it comes to government spending, you need Democratic votes now. And what that has just basically become the way the House has run. What's really amped up recently is that you are seeing Democrats likely in the next few minutes vote on what's called a rule in the House, which typically only the majority party votes for. They're going to help that get over the top. They're going to help the Ukraine bill and the Israel components get over the top. And then if Marjorie Taylor Greene were to spark that motion to vacate, the Democrats conceivably, we'll see if they actually do it, would help him remain in office because he kept his promise on Ukraine to them.
So Democrats in our audience, would you like to see your Democratic representative, since most of the congressional districts around here are held by Democrats, those seats from those districts. If you're in a Democratic district and voted Democratic, would you like to see your Democratic member of Congress vote to help Speaker Mike Johnson keep his speakership, even though obviously he's a Republican who you oppose on most issues? Democrats, 212-433 WNYC, 212-433-9692. Call or text. Most of you probably remember that Democrats refused to do that to save Kevin McCarthy in a kind of similar situation not that long ago. Should it be different this time? 212-433-9692. Or just let the Republicans sink into more and more public dysfunction here in this election year. 212-433-9692. Democrats and Republicans, too, from the Republican districts in our area on Long Island, north of the city, Staten Island. Do you want to see Marjorie Taylor Greene and others oust Speaker Johnson from his speakership? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or anything else for Burgess Everett, Congressional Bureau Chief for Politico, on any of these things going on in Congress this week. I listed a bunch of them in the intro. There are even more. 212-433-9692 for anything you always wanted to ask a Congressional Bureau Chief but never had them over for dinner. 212-433-9692. Let's see. That thing that you said is coming up in just a few minutes, this vote on the rules, this really matters, but this is obscure to a lot of the general public. They know what the issues are, but what's this thing that they call the rules, and how does it relate to the issues?
Basically, all of this does, and it's important, but what it does is it unlocks those final votes, which are likely to happen on Saturday, to pass this legislation. It structures the debate and how the House will consider this. So unless the House has an overwhelming majority, over two-thirds, they need to pass rules or legislation. It's a typical function of the House. The atypical piece of this is that you have Democrats that are going to vote for the rule. Typically, even if you would oppose a bill that comes up on the House floor, but you're in the majority, you're going to vote for the rule, because otherwise it kind of embarrasses your speaker to say that I don't even like the way you are setting up this debate. Conservatives are arguing they've been betrayed because Mike Johnson said for so long they needed a strong border component tied directly to the foreign aid package, and that is not what is going to end up passing the House. There's going to be a separate consideration of a border bill, but those things are not going to be combined.
Why not? Mike Johnson is a hawk on the border, isn't he?
He is, but there's been a fundamental disagreement ever since the Senate created its bipartisan border package, which changed some asylum and parole laws and also beefed up border security. The House Republicans have wanted a stricter bill called H.R. 2, which has Remain in Mexico, the border wall, things like that in it. But what really happened here is that the Senate was on track to pass something that did link those two things together. Former President Donald Trump killed it a couple months ago because he wanted to keep this issue alive in the election. He did not want Congress to pass anything dealing with this. A lot of Republicans think this is their best political argument to keep the House majority, win the Senate majority, and take back the White House. And that political argument ultimately prevailed. And that's how we ended up where we are today.
Let's talk about the Trump role in this for a minute, because I was very surprised, actually, to see on Politico this morning this language: Trump has lent Johnson his qualified support. He had already publicly stood with Johnson in Mar-a-Lago and rejected Marjorie Taylor Greene's push for his removal if Johnson went forward with the Ukraine bill yesterday. Trump held firm in the Johnson camp when he posted something on social media that attacked Europeans for their allegedly skimpy support for Ukraine. So what? And then it quotes someone familiar with the former president's thinking, saying Trump intentionally did not come down on one side or the other. I thought Trump famously is anti-Ukraine and pro-Putin.
Well, what's sort of happened is he's put out a statement that allows everybody to take away a little bit of what they want from it. And so you actually did have people like Matt Gaetz and J.D. Vance, who oppose Ukraine aid, saying that was a good statement from Trump that sided with them. You also had people who support Ukraine aid who recognize that Trump was not advising people to vote against the bill. I think Trump is very clear when he wants to stop something. You saw that earlier this month when he said kill FISA. He wanted to kill the FISA bill. The House Republicans did exactly that. They regrouped, shaved some years off of it, and eventually passed it. But when he wants to stop something, he's very clear about it. He's very effective at it, as we just talked about with the border bill. So when he puts out this statement yesterday that attacks the Europeans, says Ukraine is important to us, but more important to Europe, when you look at that, it's for Trump very nuanced. It gives people a little bit on all sides of the debate, a little bit to work with, but it does not explicitly say stop this bill. And that's what it would take, I think, to really amp this up a notch on the right.
And we'll talk about that FISA bill. That's the post 9/11 Surveillance Act that I thought had most of its opponents on the left. But Trump and the MAGA right are coming out against that. And Trump successfully killed that bill, as you were just describing. Hold that thought. We'll get to that part of it. But let's take some phone calls. Desiree in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Burgess Everett, Congressional Bureau Chief for Politico. Hi, Desiree.
Yes. Hi, Brian. I would want my representative, who is Yvette Clark, I would want her to vote to keep Mike Johnson in office, just because I think the Republicans thrive on a lot of the chaos, and we don't need it unless we have enough votes to be able to get in a Democratic speaker. Then all bets are off. But I have a question, because I want to know if the same way we have to, you know, we need Democratic input to advance these bills and to get votes and stuff like that, is there any way that Democrats could vote to get rid of this one House representative can challenge the speaker thing, or do we not have enough leverage for that, or is it an internal thing and we can't interfere.
Thank you, Desiree. Burgess?
Yeah, there had been discussions about adding something that would increase the threshold on that motion to vacate, adding that to this whole package. The thinking being that the people that are going to vote against the Ukraine bill are the same people that would probably come for the speaker's head after this bill passed. The problem with that is that it sort of shows weakness. Internally, it shows that you don't have your whole party coalition together, which, you know, seems obvious to all of us who are watching the House on a daily basis. But doing that and having to rely on Democrats to increase that threshold, it seemed like a bridge too far. So the speaker actually put out a statement yesterday saying there was not majority support in the House for doing that. I would think the next speaker, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, is going to deal with this in some way. The Republicans just didn't have the votes to elect Kevin McCarthy speaker without making this concession, and he eventually allowed this concession, and they've been unable to change it since then. So it's really a little bit of an internal politics thing from Mike Johnson why that didn't ultimately get included in this package.
Desiree, thank you. Stephen in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Great show as always, Brian.
Thank you.
Thanks for your great service to our to the whole world.
Very kind.
Yes, I definitely support attempting to keep this guy in if he's going to follow through, because Ukraine is in a critical situation. It's a life and death struggle over there. God only knows what that country will look like if Putin succeeds. And in my view, he's not satisfied to stop at any particular, you know, signpost, you know. So, and it cedes power to the Democrats, our fellow from New York, the minority leader. All of a sudden, he has power now. So this power-sharing deal could work out, in my opinion. I definitely support the idea, and that's all I have to say about that situation. Thank you once again for taking my call.
Thank
have a great
you.
Day.
You too. Thank you, Stephen. And it's really interesting what we're getting on the phones, a lot that are like those two callers who we just heard, Burgess, and I'm going to read some of the text. We need to get aid out, especially to Ukraine. I have no love for anyone or anything Trump supports, but we can't let Ukraine go down. Another one, if the Democrats work with Mike Johnson, that would be the best thing to happen in Congress in years. Yes, Dams, another text. Vote for Speaker Johnson. He shows a fiduciary responsibility to his position, even though I don't agree with his ideology. And we're getting many, many texts like that. I'll read you one on the other side from a different Democrat in a second. But Burgess, I can tell you that when we did the same kind of call-in and invitation for people to write in, at the same point in Kevin McCarthy's speakership, we had basically zero people calling with, yeah, save Kevin McCarthy because he helped fund the government with, you know, Democratic votes. Instead, it was, no, Kevin McCarthy is an insurrectionist. Well, Mike Johnson is an insurrectionist. But now the script, just based on our small, informal, thoroughly unscientific sample, the script has completely flipped.
Yeah, and I think, frankly, that's just because Speaker Johnson is just taking a bigger risk politically than Kevin McCarthy did. If you recall, when Kevin McCarthy was ousted, he had not made a formal commitment on Ukraine. He was just passing something to fund the government for 6 weeks. We've seen Mike Johnson pass a longer funding bill that was honestly pretty close to what he said he was not going to do, which was a big sweeping, what they call in Congress, an omnibus. It ended up being a couple components, but it was basically that. And now he's making a commitment on $60 billion in Ukraine aid with the threat of the speakership hanging over him. So I think Democrats are seeing, you know, frankly, some courage from the speaker taking on his own party. And that's something I think they didn't think they were seeing from Kevin McCarthy, who I would argue was doing more to try to placate his party's right flank than Mike Johnson is doing right now.
Here's a question from a listener that they wrote in. Question for your guest. What is the root of the Republican opposition to funding for Ukraine? And have those reasons shifted at all in the past 2 years, meaning since Russia invaded?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is honestly rooted in Trumpism, which, you know, I know is a generality, but I think for the Republicans, it's sort of on wars. It's not starting new wars. It's getting out of old ones. It's getting rid of an adventurism in foreign policy. And so I think the argument has been that funding Ukraine is a slippery slope that is making the war worse with Russia, and that they just need to cut a deal with the Russians and end the war. And so that's been sort of the argument we've been getting from a lot of the conservatives who oppose Ukraine funding. You know, Marjorie Taylor Greene's been saying she doesn't, you know, think Putin is going to keep sweeping through Europe in the same way that Nazi Germany did. So that's been the argument that we've been hearing. But I do think a lot of it is rooted in where former President Trump came down on this issue. And I'm not sure we would see the same sort of hand-wringing over this, honestly, if he hadn't become tied into the Ukraine political fight.
And now here's a Republican calling in who I think is unhappy with what Speaker Johnson is doing. Alam in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hey there, thanks for calling in.
Hey, thanks for having me. I wouldn't call myself a Republican, but I'd say, you know, one issue with Johnson, for example, or really both the Democrat and the Republican Party, is neither are representing their respective parties or their people. Honestly, it's kind of just become a blurred line where everyone does whatever they want, kind of. So my thing is, someone like Thomas Massie, for example, who is a Republican, would be kind of a better fit, more objective, looking at Ukraine in, you know, one way, kind of more of an isolationist viewpoint. And for example, Israel aid, which is conditional. All aid to every country is conditional upon how they use it, right? So what do you think the reality of someone like Massie getting into a speaker position is, you know, is it there at all? And also, Johnson, you know, continues to go back on his word and is not doing what he says he'll do. Let's go back to Jefferson's, you know, kind of isolationist ideas. It's better. No more wars. Let's focus on the United States.
Interesting. Thank you very much. Burgess, a lot in there.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that Thomas Massie, he's got kind of a Rand Paul viewpoint. It's sort of almost a pre-Trump Tea Party libertarian era strand of thinking on foreign policy. I do think Thomas Massie does represent a sliver of the Republican Party, but I do think it's a bit of a sliver, and I don't believe he would have the internal juice, nor I think would he want to be speaker. I don't think he'd be in position to win the speakership. That's not to say that his politics don't represent a lot of people in this country, but I would say the way that the Republican Party is divided now, he's still sort of on the outer, you know, fringe, for lack of a better word, of the conference.
Interesting texts coming from our listeners, like one who writes, Americans claim to want our elected officials to work together, but consistently vote for chaos. And another one, we have evidence that people are actually a lot less polarized than their elected officials. I said I was going to read another text from a Democrat who doesn't want their party to cooperate to keep Speaker Johnson speaker, but we have a phone call to that effect now. So I'm going to take Jay in Somerset County to articulate that. Jay, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hi, Brian. So I don't trust this guy, first of all. Okay. He goes and meets with Trump. I mean, what does Trump have to do with any of this stuff? And he goes and meets with him. I don't trust him. You know, you help him today. And who's to say that he's not going to turn on the Democrats? And secondly, I want to see the Republicans in chaos. I think the U.S. population overall is tired of their drama. And I just want to see this play out and see what the idiots, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, I want her, you know, call her bluff and see what happens. But I would not help this guy because I don't trust him, period.
Jay, thank you very much. What about the campaign overlay of that? One of the reasons that Jay gave, I mean, the Democrats are, you know, hoping to take control of the House. They're only a couple of votes shy of that right now, a couple of seats shy. If they can flip a few seats, they could control the House of Representatives next year. Why aren't their campaign officials telling their members, look, let's just make this Republican Party look as bad as it possibly can, as dysfunctional as they actually are, the Democrats might say, and that'll help them go down in flames or at least not have the majority come November.
I mean, I think there's no question that if that were to occur and if Speaker Johnson were to be ousted and devolve into chaos again, it would hurt Republicans' position, not only in keeping the House, but nationally. Back in October, when Kevin McCarthy was ousted and they could not get another speaker in for several weeks, everyone we talked to was saying that it was bad for the Republican Party as a whole. So I do think there is that argument. But, you know, as we talked about a little bit earlier, the difference is what Mike Johnson's commitment has been to Democrats and following through on it, and how that would play within the Democratic caucus. I also don't know how many votes you really are going to need to prevent the motion to vacate from succeeding. There were 8 Republicans who voted to get rid of Kevin McCarthy. That means you really wouldn't need to see that many Democrats help Mike Johnson if it was a similar level of rebellion. So you might be able to have all the party leaders and most of the party vote to get rid of Mike Johnson and just have a handful of moderate Democrats help protect him.
I see, because it might only take a handful of votes, because there may only be a handful of Republicans who actually vote to vacate, is what you're saying, right?
Correct. Or you could even play games with voting present on something like that instead of voting yes, or even there might be absences that help you out, too. So I still think you get to that vote and it makes the Republican Party look bad no matter what, because it's going to weaken Mike Johnson's internal position, having to rely on Democrats to save his job.
Could it also be that there are enough Democrats who actually just think it's important enough to support Ukraine that they would rather play ball with Speaker Johnson and maybe sacrifice a little bit of electoral advantage in order to do something that they think is really important for the world?
I think that is definitely probably the case with some of these folks. And I also think, like, if you look at a practical level of what is it like being a member of the House of Representatives on a daily basis, it's been a pretty crummy year and a half. I don't think people want to have a crappy job to go to every day. And so I do think that there's a little bit of pragmatism in a semi-functional House of Representatives for the next 6 months, so these people don't tear their hair out.
When's this vacate vote likely to happen?
The way it structures is it would be after probably after a recess, which is scheduled for next week. That would be my guess. But, you know, there's Marjorie Taylor Greene could play with the timing on that and bring it up later. She's not able to bring it up right away. So it would be something that would play out in the days and weeks after, presumably, the House passes this foreign aid package.
All right, we're going to take a short break and bring up some of the other issues in Congress this week that I set up in the intro with Burgess Everett, Congressional Bureau Chief for Politico. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue at the end of this very busy week in Congress with Burgess Everett, Congressional Bureau Chief for Politico. Burgess, I want to move on to the two impeachment proceedings this week. There was one of Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas that got all the way to the Senate. We'll talk about that second. There is also still this Joe Biden impeachment inquiry going on in the House, and I'm going to play about a minute of this shouting match between the Investigations Committee Chair Republican James Comer and Democrat Jamie Raskin. But do you want to set this up for us before we listen to them yell at each other? What exactly was going on in this committee?
I mean, look, we've been seeing this impeachment inquiry play out for months now without really a smoking gun necessarily tying Joe Biden to Hunter Biden's illegal activities and shady activities overseas. And so there's been frustration building in both parties with regards to that. I think Republicans initially had thought they were going to be able to get there and send an impeachment trial over to the Senate for the president, which, as we'll get to in a minute, is very different than a impeachment trial for a cabinet secretary. Democrats have been really getting increasingly angry that this is still going on and has not been totally derailed at this point. I think they know Republicans don't have the votes to impeach the president, and I think they think that there is not going to be that smoking gun in the end, so they kind of want to stop the innuendo. Comer, who is the chairman of this committee, has been sending out fundraising solicitations, saying he's going to make kind of a recommendation, a criminal referral, with regards to the end of this investigation rather than an impeachment vote. So that's sort of the backdrop of what went down this week.
Yeah, I mean, the Democrats would say no smoking gun, no vaping gun, no edible gun, no any kind of gun, no evidence. And that's at the heart of this exchange between James Comer and Jamie Raskin. It'll be obvious to you who's who.
I don't know what you're business talking were they about. In? Well, what Biden? What business is the Comers what? In? You're talking about lots of people. There's lots of people in the family.
I'm a farmer. Your impeachment, I have land. I
your impeachment
land.
Investigation
I sell
must identify a high Bidens crime do? And misdemeanor.
What did they do?
I'll tell you what Joe Biden did. He was a senator of the United States. Then he wrote a book, and he said he made the most money ever made in his life, millions of dollars on his book, and he gave $1 million.
That's what his family did.
That's what
that's why Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Romania, China, Russia, that's why they paid the Biden family money, because of Joe Biden.
None of those governments paid anyone any money.
So, somebody needs therapy here, but it's nobody on our side of the aisle, okay?
Back to the China hearing.
You had your chance. I would like my time restored.
Your time was expired.
You interrupted me. I want my time restored.
You had your time. You went above, and I let Ms. Thornton go a minute.
You know what?
Sit down, everybody. Come back. This is about China. We asked a simple question. No, Ms. Presley, you're out of order. Sit down.
Mr. Chairman.
The grown-ups of the United States of America, ladies and gentlemen, modeling for the children of the United States of America. To actually peel that back, Burgess, on what the alleged issue was, it sounded to me like what the Republican Comer is saying is Joe Biden made a lot of money in the years after he was vice president, so we have to investigate to see if it was corrupt. Is that sort of, and we know that Hunter Biden, was involved in companies in Ukraine and China. Therefore, the president maybe did something impeachable. I mean, is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair summary. And I do think that it's in Comer's best interest, both internally and nationally, to kind of keep there some sort of mystery about they never got to the full bottom of the truth here.
And so what comes next, if anything?
Yeah, I think this will ultimately end in some sort of referral or statement from Comer about what the Justice Department should do with regard to Joe Biden. And we have an excellent reporter, Jordan Carney, who's been covering this for us for months, and she's written that it's very unlikely to culminate in an actual House impeachment of the president.
And what happened with Mayorkas? That came and went so quickly. You know, for people who may have heard a headline on a newscast, the House impeached. And remember, folks, an impeachment is like an indictment. It's not a conviction. That would have to take place in the Senate. So Mayorkas was impeached by the House, which means it goes to the Senate. And for people who watch the Trump impeachments, for older people who watch the Clinton impeachments, when there really were trials in the Senate, there actually wasn't here, right?
No. And I did cover both of those Trump impeachments, and this was just extremely different. This was about 3 hours of essentially dilatory motions from Republicans to try to get the Senate to adjourn the court of impeachment or go into closed session to debate it. What happened was the Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, and a bunch of Republicans basically had signed off on a deal to have some actual debate about the merits of the impeachment, have a couple of votes on whether it should go to trial or whether to create an impeachment committee. And that was rejected by Eric Schmidt. He's a Republican from Missouri. He said anything short of a full trial is being complicit in you guys shutting this down. And so we ended up with just a few procedural votes on the Senate floor, and Schumer started things off. He's the majority leader, so he gets the first recognition. He started things off by raising a point of order that the impeachment was unconstitutional. Republicans tried to knock that off, but Democrats have the majority, and in the court of impeachment, a majority rules the day, and found both articles to be unconstitutional, and then adjourned the impeachment trial, and that was the whole shebang.
What's the Republicans' best argument, if there even is a best argument, on why allegedly Mayorkas committed an impeachable offense, as opposed to they just have a policy disagreement with him about the border?
It was funny, actually. The argument, at least in the Senate, was very different than the House, because the argument in the Senate wasn't even necessarily focused on that. It was merely focused on debating what and hearing the evidence of those things, because I think ultimately, if a trial had gone through, you would have had a bipartisan acquittal of Mayorkas. So it was less about the merits and more the Republican argument in the Senate was less about the merits and more about Democrats being unwilling to basically turn the Senate floor into a referendum on the Biden administration and Mayorkas' treatment on the border. So they didn't even get that far, and they were barred from even debating the merits of it because they didn't accept that deal to do so.
Another very interesting thing this week, an issue that some people are very involved with, a lot of listeners may not really know what it is, FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. I mentioned before that originated as a post 9/11 law. I know it's been revised since then. Trump was against it and killed it, but I thought the left was originally against it in the post 9/11 years as too much surveillance without enough court supervision. So tell us about this FISA reauthorization and who was for it and against it and why.
Well, first of all, there's some urgency here. It expires in about 13 hours. There's debate on whether it really matters whether it expires, but the law would lapse without action by midnight on Saturday. You're correct that the liberals had typically been the biggest opponents of these programs, but basically, going back to your listener who mentioned Thomas Massie and also Rand Paul in the Senate, there's been a growing strand of anti-surveillance Republicans in the Senate and House. And I think Trump actually accelerated that. So you definitely have what we would call colloquially a strange bedfellows coalition who are seeking to, at a minimum, change this FISA law. Now, the FISA law allows for warrantless surveillance of foreign targets. This is the Section 702 program that we're debating. So it's a lot of acronyms, a lot of numbers, but at its heart, that's what it does. It allows warrantless surveillance of foreign targets. The issue here has always been, in doing so, it sweeps up some communication of Americans. And so the big debate has been whether the intelligence community should be able to access Americans' information without a warrant. So that's probably the biggest thing that we're going to see here. The Biden administration's been fighting efforts to change that very hard. They've been on the Hill all week, top officials briefing senators, classified, unclassified, trying to kill these attempts to change the bill. And so here we are just a few hours before the deadline, and we're waiting for the Senate to come up with a voting deal on those amendments that we just talked about on warrants and pass it before midnight after voting on those amendments.
Would it be fair to say that Trump and the MAGA right oppose what war on terror era Republicans used to be very much for, because the biggest terrorism threats in this country these days come from people associated with the MAGA right? And so they don't want people like these January 6th convicts who Trump calls hostages being investigated by the government?
You know, It's interesting because Trump wanted to kill FISA last week, but after some changes, he sort of backed off that. Oh. And after they changed the expiration date from 5 years to 2 years, which if Trump were to win, would expire during his presidency, he would be able to handle the next reauthorization. And I also think it's worth, you know, I think mostly that opposition has come from the Russia investigation and how that swept up some of the Trump campaign's communications. It's important to look back, though, at what Trump did when he was president. He signed a reauthorization of this program, the very reauthorization that's expiring now. So it's something that you can throw eggs at from the sidelines. But once you're governing, and I think Mike Johnson is experiencing this as well, because he was one of these FISA critics before. Once you're governing, you're getting all this intelligence, you're seeing what these programs actually do. It has a way of making members of Congress and presidents like Trump end up embracing this program, at least to some degree, to keep it going.
Right. How one campaigns and how one governs, not necessarily the same. So last thing, you wrote an article for Politico on the Democrats' new spending campaign to try to hold their slim Senate majority. And does this relate to FISA in some way?
I would say not necessarily related to FISA. I do think that the Republicans are likely to use the Mayorkas trial in a lot of their paid advertisements this fall. So I do think these votes this week will probably show up there. I don't know how salient they will be because of that strange bedfellows coalition we just talked about, where Republicans like Josh Hawley are working with Democrats like Ron Wyden. It's a lot harder to weaponize, for lack of a better term, these FISA votes in Senate races, I would say.
So we talk so much on this show, and I think the political national media generally talk so much about the presidential campaign, but the Republicans have a teeny tiny majority in the House. The Democrats have a teeny tiny majority in the Senate. Both houses of Congress are really in play, and that really matters. So these campaigns deserve a lot of attention between now and November, right?
Totally. And the Senate races are just very challenging for the Democrats because of their exposure across the map. Joe Manchin retiring in West Virginia basically loses them that seat. So you're basically starting at a 50 seat cap unless you can surprise. Democrats can surprise and win in Florida and Texas. And so those are both pretty hard states to win in. And so to keep the majority, Democrats have to keep the White House, win Senate races in Ohio, Montana, Wisconsin, Nevada, Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Those are all tough states, especially Ohio and Montana. And so it's a very weird thing where a lot of people who study this stuff for a living think the House is likely to flip to Democrats and the Senate is likely to flip to Republicans. And that's because of the way these Senate seats come up. Only a third of them come up every 2 years. And that creates a very different dynamic than these House races, which are really tied to national politics. I mean, Joe Biden could have a great day and win, and Democrats could still lose these Senate seats in Ohio and Montana because they're in such red states.
Burgess Everett, Congressional Bureau Chief for Politico. Thanks for this Friday morning shot. When you have so much to cover, you're even telling us in real time about things that are going to happen any minute. So thanks a lot for today, Burgess.
Sure, Brian. Thanks. I'll come on anytime. Appreciate you.